From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, how the junk science of eugenics and anti-immigration sentiment merged in a 1924 restrictive law that kept out Jews, Italians, Greeks, and Eastern Europeans. It's the subject of a new book by today's guest, Daniel Okrent. One justification for keeping certain groups of people out of America was that they scored poorly on intelligence tests. Badly designed tests with questions like this.
Is Bud Fisher A, choose one, outfielder, cartoonist, or novelist? Now, if you've just been in the country for 5 years and you don't speak English terribly well, how are you possibly going to answer a question like that?
Okrent hears echoes of the past in today's anti-immigrant rhetoric. And John Powers looks back on 7 seasons of HBO's satirical political series Veep, which concludes Sunday. That's on Fresh Air. We're going to talk about an earlier part of immigration history when, as my guest Daniel Okrent writes, a perverse form of science gave respectability to the drastic limits imposed on the number of Jews, Italians, Greeks, Poles, and various other Eastern and Southern Europeans seeking to come to America. The, quote, science was eugenics, which theorized that traits like intelligence and morality were inherited, and therefore, through selective breeding, you could improve the quality of the human race. Of course, the converse was also believed to be true. Certain individuals or groups of people would pollute the bloodline. Those undesirables were the people the restrictive immigration law of 1924 was designed to keep out. Okrent is the author of the new book, The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept 2 generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. He hears the rhetoric of that era echoing today. Daniel Okrent, welcome back to Fresh Air.
I'm very happy to be here.
Did you write about anti-immigration movements of the past to put President Trump's hardline immigration policies into historical context?
No, I can't say that I did. That just happened to be an unfortunate coincidence, or maybe commercially a fortunate coincidence. I began to write this book because I stumbled across the story of eugenics in America in the early part of the 20th century. And as I looked further into it, in addition to those things that many people have written about, particularly planned breeding and sterilization, I stumbled across this immigration story where eugenics was used as a primary weapon in the effort to keep Southern and Eastern Europeans out of the country, resulting in a law passed in 1924 in place for 41 years that really gave the lie to the notion that we were a nation of immigrants.
So your grandparents, like so many Americans, grandparents or great-grandparents, came to the U.S. in the early 1900s before the restrictive 1924 Act. Tell us a little bit what immigration from Europe or Eastern Europe was like then. What did it take to get entry into America?
To get entry into America before the 1921 Act, you needed to get on a boat, come across the ocean, show up at Ellis Island and not have a contagious disease or any other very obvious disability or a criminal record or be suspected of certain criminal activities. But beyond that, the door was wide, wide open to the huddled masses that Emma Lazarus wrote about.
And describe to us a little bit what Ellis Island was like in the early 1900s.
Ellis Island opens in 1892, and within a few years, it becomes one of the busiest port spots anywhere in the U.S. There are hundreds of thousands of people, in some years, millions of people coming through Ellis Island. Long snaking lines, detention dormitories, hospitalization areas. It was a very, very busy place and a very alienating place for a lot of people because of the examination that people had to go through, particularly for tuberculosis, trachoma, and other diseases. But once through the line and then onto the ferry boat that took people to Manhattan, it was really a wonderful place to have been.
And it's interesting, you describe the detention dorms in Ellis Island as being really large rooms divided into cages.
They put people into cages really to kind of as holding pens. Cages may be a little bit too scary a word. They were wire walls that kept people apart from other people. And it was for segregation by sex. It was for segregation by people who might have diseases. It wasn't detention remotely like the detention that people coming across the southern border are submitting to today.
Mm-hmm. Just tell us a little bit about why there was such a large surge of immigrants in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
A couple of things that happen in the late 19th century that lead to the enormous immigration that begins really around 1880 and then goes into the retro rockets fire around 1890. One was the creation of a continent-wide railroad network in Europe that enabled people from the interior parts of many nations to get to ports. There was also the promise of something better, and that is each family or family member would come to the U.S. and write back to relatives at home. The streets may not be paved with gold, and they may be asking us to pave them, but there's real opportunity here. Desperate poverty, particularly in southern Italy and other areas, was a driving force for many, many people. And if you could scrape together the dollars that could get you to a port and onto a boat, you would want to come.
And of course, for Jews, there were the pogroms that were, Jews were living basically in ghettos and they were being attacked. So they had a good reason to flee.
The Jews of the Russian Empire, now Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine, various other modern nations, beginning in 1882, there was a severe restriction on their rights under Tsar Alexander. Not only were there pogroms in which people were subject to horrible physical crimes, but also limitation of where you could live, what occupation you could go into. Freedom of movement was radically curtailed, and people had a very, very strong reason to want to get out.
So during this period of the late 1800s and early 1900s, before the restrictive immigration laws that we'll be talking about momentarily, the immigrants that were considered good immigrants and immigrants that were considered dirty, filthy, stupid immigrants, what was the dividing line?
Well, it depends on who's doing the considering, but I think we're talking specifically about the Protestant elites of the Northeast, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, who had enormous political power at the time. And they saw immigrants coming from the countries that they had come from and people of similar ethnic background, which is to say the countries of Northwestern Europe, the UK, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, Germany, all Protestant countries. They were okay. And those who were coming from the Catholic and the Jewish countries were simply not. And it was almost universal, except, I suppose, for France. But the Eastern and Southern Europeans were looked upon by some of these people as really less than human. And the sociologist Edward Ross, who was later the national chairman of the American Civil Liberties Union, he described, this is, a very liberal and progressive man, he described looking at the immigrants, the Eastern European immigrants in Union Square in New York, and seeing what he described as hirsute, low-browed, big-faced persons of obviously low mentality, ox-like people who clearly belong in skins, in wattled huts at the close of the Ice Age. It's a pretty terrifying image and characteristic of those who wish to close the door.
So the first exclusionary immigration law was passed in 1882, and that was the Chinese Exclusion Act to keep out both skilled and unskilled Chinese laborers. Why were the Chinese people singled out by that law? I mean, Chinese people built the railroads.
That's why they were singled out, one of the reasons, because it was a labor issue. The railroad magnate Jim Hill, he said, why would I want to hire one American to do this kind of work when I can hire six Chinese for the same amount of money to do it? So the notion of the jobs that were disappearing to the Chinese, they created an enormous backlash in the nascent labor movement of the late 19th century. And then, of course, there was the racial issue. They were different. They were different, and therefore, by the code of the time and of too many eras, they were lesser as well.
So let's talk about the science of the junk science of eugenics.
Thank you.
So what was the, pseudoscientific basis of this?
The origin of eugenics is in England in the latter half of the 19th century. It really comes out of Darwin, in a way, out of some very good science. Darwin upsets the entire balance of the scientific world with his discovery and propagation of the ideas of evolution. And then once you establish that we are not all derived from the same people, from Adam and Eve, which was the prevailing view of the time, then we learn that we are not all the same. We are not all brothers, if you wish to take that particular position. And the early eugenicists believed that and thought that we could control the nature of the population of a nation, the UK at first or the US, by selective breeding. Let's have only the good breed with the good, and let's not let the less than good breed. Francis Galton, who was actually a cousin of Darwin's, who was the man who named eugenics and was its first most vocal advocate, he suggested early on that the UK find the 5,000 best young men and the 5,000 best young women and pair them off in arranged marriages, which would take place in one huge ceremony in Westminster Abbey, presided over by Queen Victoria. And each of these families, these new couples, would be given a yearly stipend. So instead of working, they could get down to the business of making better people, better babies for the UK. Now, this was a kind of a positive view in a way, but it implied the opposite that became popular in the U.S., that we have to stop the reproduction of those who don't improve our so-called race, who don't make the country a better place. And this negative form of eugenics is the one that begins to bubble into popularity in the U.S. around 1910, 1912.
So it wasn't just like intelligence that was considered to be an inherited trait. It was like morality.
Yeah, that's a really stunning thing. You find some very well-established scientists, Fairfield Osborne, the head of the American Museum of Natural History for 25 years, he outright declared that it is not just intelligence, it is also morality that is inherited, and criminality is inherited. And it's really stunning to think that people who are very, very well-credentialed in the natural sciences could believe these things. But if you begin your belief by thinking that certain peoples are inferior to other peoples, it's very easy to adapt your science to suit your own prejudice.
And the eugenicists had ways of evaluating which ethnic groups were the smartest and which were the idiots. Let's talk a little bit about some of those tests. Go ahead.
Well, there were any number of tests in various places, almost all of them of equal unreliability, determining whether people were of sufficient intelligence. One of the most famous ones was the so-called Alpha test that was given to nearly 2 million soldiers in World War I by Robert M. Yerkes, who is now memorialized in the Yerkes Primate Research Center in Atlanta, federal facility. Yerkes gave tests that included questions that were sort of almost Jeopardy questions, although in reverse. You know, a question like, is Bud Fisher a, choose one, outfielder, cartoonist, or novelist? Now, if you've just been in the country for 5 years and you don't speak English terribly well, how are you possibly going to answer a question like that? But it was taken seriously as a measure of intelligence to such a degree that Carl Brigham, who later became famous for inventing the SAT, a Princeton psychologist, he said, well, these are the kind of questions, if you know the answers, it shows that you've been in America and you're an American, and that's what we're trying to establish. We're trying to find people who deserve to be in America.
I'm going to mention a couple of other questions here because these are just, these are
They're
incredible.
They're pretty great.
Yeah, okay. The Wyandotte is a kind of horse, fowl, cattle, or granite.
All right. I'm thinking really hard. The beads of sweat are forming on my forehead. I'm going to go with cattle.
You're wrong. I looked it up.
See?
There's a Wyandotte chicken.
So kick me out of the country. I don't deserve to be here
by
the standards.
You do not. Mm-hmm. Okay. So who are some of the famous, powerful, respected people who supported eugenics and eugenics-based restrictions on immigration?
Well, there are any number of them, ranging from the political figures like Theodore Roosevelt early on and Henry Cabot Lodge. And then in the scientific community, I mentioned Henry Fairfield Osborne of the American Museum of Natural History, Charles Davenport of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, who was truthfully the leading geneticist in the U.S. at the time. And then people of surprising provenance, I'd say, Margaret Sanger, for one.
She was the the mother of the birth control movement.
Right. And if you really stop to think about it, there's a real connection between the idea of birth control. It's controlled breeding. And the entire eugenics movement was predicated on the idea of controlling breeding. Sanger, I believe, is a little bit of a complicated story because she would have made an alliance with anyone who supported the birth control movement. The eugenicists, by and large, did, so she made common cause with them. Where it gets squirrely is she does get very close to some of them, and at times she makes statements about, look at the horrible things going on in the slums. The slums were overwhelmingly Eastern and Southern European immigrants at the time. We have to stop their reproduction, or the slums are going to get worse. We have to keep them out of the country, or the slums are going to get worse.
You quote Calvin Coolidge just before he was sworn in as vice president in 1921. In Good Housekeeping, he was quoted as saying, "Biological laws will tell us that certain divergent people will not mix or blend. The dead weight of alien accretion stifles national progress." Wow.
This is a critical moment when Coolidge, who's about to step into the vice presidency, he's been the governor of Massachusetts, makes this absolutely declarative statement without any hint of a doubt hovering over it, that biological laws have proven it. And from that moment on, it became sort of respectable to obey the biological laws to keep out the Eastern and Southern Europeans. One didn't have to use terms like Italians, Jews, Greeks, Romanians, Hungarians. It was simply those people who are deficient scientifically. Of course, the science was bogus and soon discredited, but it carried the day. I think that there would have been immigration restriction anyway in 1924, but this made it respectable.
So World War I intervenes while this movement is growing in popularity. What impact did World War I have on the eugenics movement?
Among other things, it yields a new piece of terminology that plays right into the immigration debate. It was called by some of the leading propagandists for the eugenic idea, the White Civil War. Here was white nations fighting against other white nations, and they were nations largely of Northern and Western Europe, killing each other, and not only killing each other, but presumably the soldiers who were dying were the best of those nations. This was an alarm that went off loud and clear among the eugenicists. They saw that it was an opportunity to spread their doctrine further by pointing out the damage that had been wrought by that war. The other thing that happened is at the end of the war unleashed another huge wave of immigration into the country. There hadn't been a lot coming from Europe between 1914 and 1918, but when the war was over, that devastated continent was beginning to empty out of people coming to the U.S. You know, one of the leading proponents of immigration restriction, the man who really financed the movement, was a pretty otherwise wonderful man named Joseph Lee of Boston. He was a great progressive. He supported all sorts of civil rights. He supported women's rights. He thought that the schools of Boston should be kept open at night so immigrants could be educated, and he became chairman of the Boston School Committee so he could arrange that. But at the same time, he was writing such things to friends as saying, "All Europe might soon be drained of Jews, to its benefit, no doubt, but not to ours." He feared that the U.S. would become, he said, a Dago nation, and explained he believed as a result in exclusion by race. And World War I popularized those ideas. It enabled them to spread. Here's this new unleashing of a stream of immigrants coming in. It must be stopped up.
So in 1917, an immigration act is passed in the U.S. that has a literacy test component in it. The literacy test had been a very controversial part of previous immigration laws that were vetoed. So what was the literacy test designed to do?
The literacy test was designed to create a filter that would really keep out the uneducated. And the uneducated were much more likely to come from these suspect nations than they were to come from Northwestern Europe, where levels of education were much higher. When Henry Cabot Lodge introduced that bill in Congress in 1895, he said that the countries it would affect directly are those in Eastern and Southern Europe, where we don't want so many people to be coming from. And it wouldn't stop the influx of people from Northwestern Europe. It was vetoed by Grover Cleveland. Another such law 12 years later, 15 years later, was vetoed by William Howard Taft. Then Woodrow Wilson vetoed it twice. And finally, 1917, on the brink of war, it passes. And what it had going for it at that time was the support, the beginning efflorescence of the eugenics movement. So it was no longer racism. It was science. Wilson, despite his own well-documented prejudice against black people, he knew it was politically inadvisable to be aggressively opposing the continued immigration of from nations where newcomers had already won the vote. But when you apply the idea of science to it, it's no longer prejudicial. And from 1917 forward, through the passage of the first restriction law in 1921 and then the permanent law in 1924, the argument no longer uses the names of any of those countries. It doesn't mention people by race or ethnicity. It is simply a question of numbers coming from certain places.
My guest is journalist Daniel Okrent. His new book is called The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. After a break, we'll talk about how America's eugenics movement and the 1924 restrictive immigration law were cited approvingly by Hitler and the Nazis. And critic John Powers will give us his take on why the HBO satirical political series Veep is so funny. The seventh and final season concludes Sunday. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simple. Along with great value, they provide the tools and support you need to navigate the markets, all to help your money work hard for you. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
Let's get back to our interview with Daniel Okrent about his new book, The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. In 1924, a new immigration act is passed that is very exclusionary. And you say it marked the culmination of 3 decades of agitation and debate about immigration. What were the restrictions or quotas that were set up for different groups?
There are 2 parts to it. First, there's an overall quota. At various times, it was 300,000 people, then it got chopped down to, I believe it was 162,000 people. But the question, the second part, is where did these people come from? And it was decided that, well, let's continue to reflect the population of America as it has become. So we will decide where people can come from based on how many people of their same nationality were already here. So to use really reductive, simple math, if 10% of the current American population came from country A, then 10% of that year's immigrants could come from country A. Except, and this is probably the most malign and dishonest thing that came out of this entire movement, they didn't do this on the basis of the 1920 census, which had been conducted just 4 years before, or the 1910, or even the 1900, but those numbers were based on the population in 1890, before the large immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe had begun. So to any question about whether there was any racist or anti-Semitic or anti-Italian intent, this established that there clearly was. Let's find that moment in history that keeps out more of these people than any other. So if you take the Italians, in the year before the first of the quota laws went into effect, more than 220,000 Italians came into the U.S., and the year after, under the quota, it was fewer than 4,000. And similar numbers stretched across Eastern and Southern Europe. Suddenly, the door had slammed in the faces of those people who had been coming in the largest numbers, based not only on bogus science, but based on a manipulation of American history itself. It had to be based on, they said, on the 1890 population, and the intent of that was clear. One of the really interesting consequences of this, if you read the 38 articles, I think it's about 20 pages of small type in the 1924 Immigration Act, you do not see anywhere the words Italian or Jew or Greek or Turk or Pole. They don't have to mention the countries because they have this absolutely innocent-seeming numerical equation to rely upon.
So did the eugenics movement directly figure into the passage of the Immigration Act of 1924?
Unquestionably. It made it a palatable act because it was based on science or presumed science. This isn't prejudice. We love these people, but they are not as good as we are. I think there would have been a restriction law in any case, but this cleansed the restriction law and I think cemented it into place in a way that it otherwise might not have been.
It's fascinating to read in your book how Hitler and the Nazis were drawing on the American eugenics movement to, like, strengthen their own movements. They were almost using some of the American eugenics, quote, findings as guidelines for themselves. You know, Hitler becomes chancellor in 1933, but he writes Mein Kampf, or at least he publishes it, in 1925, which is 1 year after the Immigration Act of 1924 is passed. And you cite a passage from Mein Kampf in which Hitler directly refers to America.
He refers as the United States as the one, this is a quote, one state in which at least weak beginnings toward a better conception of citizenship are noticeable. Among them, simply excluding certain races from naturalization. And from there, he goes on to quote in later speeches and writings, Madison Grant becomes a hero of his. And most importantly, the American eugenicists, even the most respectable of them, had for, by the time Hitler takes power in 1932-33, for nearly three decades, the German eugenicists and the American eugenicists had been working together to develop their presumed science. They were collaborators in a more respectable sense of the word, but then the collaboration becomes deadly and awful once Hitler takes over. In 1933, addressing a convention of doctors who were engaged in eugenic research, he said, "I cannot do without you for a single day, not a single hour. If not for you, if you fail me, then all is lost." And the all was his entirely eugenic view of mankind, the superiority of the Aryan race, the deficiency of various peoples who had disabilities that brought on the euthanasia of hundreds of thousands. It all kind of flows directly from the previous research. Ernst Rudin, who is a well-known, well-established psychiatrist and eugenic researcher and who had been very connected to Charles Davenport and to the other Americans who had been doing eugenic research, he said, "Only through Hitler's work has our 30-year-long dream of translating race hygiene into action finally become a reality." They celebrated it.
I do want to quote one more thing from the Nazis, and this is the official Nazi handbook for law and legislation. And it cited the American immigration law, the 1924 law, as a model for Germany.
The notion that Germany was an aberration, that Hitlerism was something that just grew like a terribly offensive weed out of the ruins of World War I and the Weimar Republic, it's given the lie by seeing how connected it was to things that were going on this side of the Atlantic.
So the Nazis were in part inspired by the American eugenics movement and the 1924 Exclusionary Immigration Act. Once the eugenicists in the U.S. became aware of what the Nazis were doing, they parted ways from the Nazis, from Germany?
Well, I would say that the eugenicists themselves didn't, but the institutions that had been sponsoring the eugenicists, that had provided them with money and office space and research staffs, they were the ones that ran away from it. The Museum of Natural History, certain science departments at Columbia, anthropologists at Harvard, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Institution of Washington, they suddenly realize, oh my God, look what we have done. Many of the eugenicists did. Some of them wrote extremely apologetic retractions even before the rise of Hitler. By the end of the 1920s, Brigham, whom I mentioned before, the man who created the SAT test and had studied the so-called deficiency of the Eastern and Southern Europeans, he retracted everything that he had said. But some of them stayed very much with the program. And one key figure, a man named Harry Laughlin, who worked with Davenport at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, he actually was awarded an honorary degree by Heidelberg University in 1936 for, the citation said, for being a leader in racial policy in the United States. And he was very proud to receive it.
But World War II basically killed off the eugenics movement as a reputable movement.
Yes, I think that by the time we are fully aware of the depredations of Hitler and the Nazis, eugenics has suffered a fatal wound. There were remnants that continued, and there are remnants that continue today. But as a meaningful social presence, it was gone.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk more. My guest is Daniel Okrent. His new book is called The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Every day, innovative companies are reinventing the way business happens. But none of that is possible without the right people. People who get packages to over 150 million delivery points affordably and on time with the latest technology and expertise. Who can help you deliver the future of commerce? The United States Postal Service. See why they deliver more e-commerce packages to homes than anyone in the country at usps.com/future.
Every day you wake up to that long to-do list. Well, Up First gives you the latest news in about 10 minutes, so you feel all caught up on the world while catching up on your life. And hey, don't forget to walk the dog. Listen to Up First every morning from NPR News.
My guest is Daniel Okrent. His new book is called The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. So we've been talking about exclusionary immigration laws in the first part of the 20th century. And then the Nazis in World War II kind of end the legitimacy, the pseudo-legitimacy of the eugenics movement. Let's skip ahead to how changing alliances in the 1950s led to changes in the restrictions on immigration.
A couple of things are in play. First, as early as 1943, because of our alliance with Chiang Kai-shek's Chinese, the restrictions on Chinese are greatly relieved after being in place for more than 60 years. When we get past 1950, there's been so little immigration from these so-called suspect countries that it isn't an issue really in the body politic in any meaningful way. And in fact, the largest immigration in the 1950s from Europe is coming from the so-called captive nations, the Eastern European countries behind the Iron Curtain. These people are suddenly made into heroes. They're not so horrible anymore. We can let them in. And this culminates in 1965. Lyndon Johnson, really as part of the Great Society, puts through Congress and signs an act that puts an end to the quotas. It ends the restrictions that were based on nationality, on ethnicity, and on race. The 1965 Act simply puts a number in place that we can have several hundred thousand people coming to this country, and it doesn't matter where they come from.
So there was a decade between the 1924 Exclusionary Immigration Act and the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act that ended those exclusionary by country or race or ethnic group policies.
Right. So think about the consequences. 41 years of these laws being in place. 41 years in which the Depression absolutely ravaged southern Italy in horrible, horrible ways, among other countries. Think also of the rise of the Nazi German programs and the Holocaust, the euthanasia, and the U.S. Congress during this period is refusing to modify the 1924 Act at all. In 1939, a law is introduced in Congress to allow 20,000 German Jewish children into the country as an emergency measure, and Congress defeats that. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt's cousin, a woman named Laura Hodling, who happened to be married to the immigration commissioner, U.S. immigration commissioner, in fact, she said at the time of this effort to bring in 20,000 German Jewish children, she said, 20,000 lovely children will grow up to be 20,000 ugly adults. And this was the prevailing attitude that had been in place for decades and was not even jarred in the slightest by what we knew was happening in Germany. The law stays in place even after World War II, when Europe is almost an endless, continuous metropolis of displaced persons camps. And it stays in place throughout the 1950s. It kind of beggars belief to think that it stayed in place that long, and it absolutely is destructive to one's feeling of the possibilities of America to think of the number of people, the hundreds of thousands, even millions of people who might have come in those years and were unable to, and we know what happened to them.
So let's jump ahead to the present. I know you wrote this book not expecting it to coincide with Trump's hardline policies and rhetoric on immigration. But the book does coincide with that now. So does his rhetoric about Mexicans and South Americans coming to the U.S. and his insistence on building a wall on the southern border, does that echo themes of the earlier anti-immigration movements?
Very much so, particularly the singling out of people by nationality. I think that one could say that today's Central Americans and today's Muslims, let's please not forget that, are the equivalent of 1924's Jews and Italians, or reverse it. The Jews and Italians then were treated and regarded as these Latin American and Muslim nationalities are today. When you choose your immigrants, when you choose your next-door neighbors on the basis of their ethnicity or their race, rather than the nature of the individual, him or herself, you're engaged in this case, official legal discrimination.
Is there any specific rhetoric that you hear echoes of the past in today?
I think that the rhetoric of criminality, the attribution of criminality not to individual criminals but to hundreds of thousands of people of various nationalities, that's very similar to the notion of moral deficiency that was hurled by the eugenicists at the southern and eastern Europeans of the 19-teens and 20s.
You know, you write about how anti-Semitism was normalized. It was just part of popular rhetoric. Give us an example of that.
It's an important thing to remember that among the upper classes, the WASP aristocracy, the episcopacy of the Northeast, that it was normative to be an anti-Semite. It would almost be surprising to find somebody who wasn't. And I do quote a young woman, well-educated, a very, very fine family, at the age of 33, writing a letter to her mother-in-law saying that she had been at a party where she met an interesting man, but he was, quote, very Jew. That man was Felix Frankfurter, later a Supreme Court justice, of course. She also said that she'd rather be hung then attend another Jew party where she was, she said, appalled by all the talk of money, jewels, and sables. Really repugnant, repellent comments. That 33-year-old woman was Eleanor Roosevelt before she broadened her horizon and changed her view and became the absolute epitome, the paragon of tolerance. So if you figure that even somebody like Eleanor Roosevelt could be thinking these things, you get a sense of how widespread and how deeply rooted they were.
Do you fear that talk about Muslims and Mexicans is being normalized like that now?
Yes, I do. I think that there are many of us who attend the lessons of history and have a different view on the nature of the human species who are resisting that's being normalized. But I think that one sees across the country this feeling that there's a reason why we are looking particularly at the Muslims and the Latin Americans. To my knowledge, all the research shows that the antipathy toward immigrants from those countries is greatest in those parts of the nation where there are the fewest of them. And those of us who live in large cities or in cities that have been previously have become havens for Muslim or Latin American immigrants, the anti-immigrant feeling is much, much lower. So we know something. We live with these people, and we realize that they are people the way that we are people. Those who aren't familiar with these people can be manipulated and told to fear and told to hate and to have those feelings of fear and hate normalized.
So do you think that there's been a constant strain in American history, and sometimes it's hidden, and sometimes it's visible, and sometimes it's small, and sometimes it's larger, but nevertheless a constant strain of xenophobia and anti-Semitism and, of course, racism?
It goes back to the 18th century. Benjamin Franklin wrote with horror about the Germans who were moving into Pennsylvania in the 1750s and how both they and their language were corrupting influences on the colony of Pennsylvania. It never goes away. It moves in cycles. And the xenophobia, the first expression is, we are the land of the free, our doors are open, come sit beside the golden door, you huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And then the next expression is, keep out. And then that goes away, and back comes the more open view of it. In 1965, when Johnson signed the Hart-Celler Act, which ended the Quota Act of 1924, as I write in the book, I said, the future of open immigration for those who really believed in non-discriminatory open immigration, it looked as bright as the brilliant sun overhead as he signed it on Liberty Island and sitting next to the Statue of Liberty. That's 50 years ago, and it looked great, and now it doesn't look so great, and let's hope that that version will come back soon enough.
Daniel Okrent, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Daniel Okrent is the author of The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. After a break, critic John Powers will look back on the HBO satirical political series Veep, which concludes Sunday after 7 seasons. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Mayo Clinic. When you're looking for a clear diagnosis and a clear path forward, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. Find out more at mayoclinic.org/answers.
What would you do if you found out a story that had shaped your identity was a lie? NPR's new podcast, White Lies, investigates a murder in Selma, Alabama from 1965.
And exposes the conspiracy that kept it unsolved. Until now. White Lies. Start listening Tuesday.
Sunday night sees the end of the 7th and final season of Veep, the acclaimed HBO political satirical series starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus as a politician. She's won an acting Emmy for each of the show's preceding 6 seasons. Our critic at large, John Powers, doesn't know whether she'll win number 7, but he says Veep has been a strangely sunny show about the darkness of politics.
As Game of Thrones builds to the final showdown with the evil queen Cersei Lannister, it seems only fair to tip our hats to HBO's other great power-hungry woman. I'm referring, of course, to Selina Meyer from Veep, the hilariously scabrous political satire that comes to an end this Sunday. Played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the inept, foul-mouthed, and boundlessly selfish Selina is surely the most groundbreakingly reprehensible heroine ever to front an American TV comedy, which may be why she's so much fun to watch. To be honest, I didn't like Veep at first, when it was about Selina's powerlessness as vice president. But in its 2nd season, Selina began to get a sniff of power. Eventually, she'd wind up president, albeit briefly, and the show suddenly kicked into gear. It's still roaring along in season 7, which finds Selina jetting from Iowa to New Hampshire to South Carolina, as she seeks the presidency yet again. Now, Veep has never been interested in issues or the party side of politics. Selina has not even been identified as a Democrat or a Republican. And the show tweaks everyone, evangelicals, knee-jerk liberals, Muslim bashers, PC lesbians, anti-vaxxers. It says that doing politics, especially inside the Beltway, is basically an unholy cross between living in a barnyard and going to high school. The people it attracts are horrible, or become so, in order to get ahead. Everybody is unprincipled, except for the dumb ones. Of course, it's tricky for a political satire to have sharp teeth when it avoids ideology and real-life figures. You never hear the name Trump, for example, or Bernie. Still, the current season has done a witty job of folding in themes that feel relevant, be it the media trumpeting mere rumors about candidates, Selina becoming the beneficiary of foreign interference in the elections, or the repellent Congressman Jonah Ryan, played by Timothy Simons, spawning a #NotMe movement of women who feel violated by his claims to have dated them. Here, Selina and her campaign team try to figure out how to win the vote of less educated white voters.
All right, then we're going to have to find a way with non-college educated whites. Like, what appeals to them? Okay, fine. What appeals to them? What do they want?
Well, my polling shows their main wants are jobs, education, and an adequate safety net.
Okay, I can speak to
I'm
that.
I'm not finished, ma'am. to be denied to African Americans.
No,
listen. We have to find a way to say those things without actually saying them.
Like a dog whistle.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, you know what? You could talk about charter schools. Mention
Come on,
something.
That's like a dog whisper.
You could reject an endorsement from a pro-Confederacy group.
That's like a dog exploding just, spaceship, yeah. You know? I mean, I need it, something loud, not too loud.
A like dog chainsaw?
No, that's too droney.
A dog snowmobile.
Why would I know what that even sounds like? I mean, seriously.
A dog leaf blower.
Yeah.
That's right.
I like that. Yes.
As this clip suggests, one of Veep's pleasures has always been its own pleasure in language. Such verbal playfulness extends to the obscene. As the show boasts the most gleefully inventive profanity since the heyday of Deadwood's Al Swearengen, the very Shakespeare of foul language. Nobody on Veep swears harder than Selena, who incarnates our present-day image of the politician as a spoiled, narcissistic self-promoter who believes in nothing except winning power, simply to have it. Insecure and driven, she'll cheerfully throw her own daughter's fiancé under the bus. She's ignorant of everything from the Constitution to the ideal she's supposed to be espousing. Her one worthy achievement, helping free Tibet, only matters to her because it can be used to let her run for president again. Selena could easily come off as depressingly dark. But there's a reason Louis-Dreyfus has surpassed Lucille Ball as television's most honored comic actress. Bursting with comic charisma, she flings herself into this juicy role with an amoral delight that's strangely upbeat, if not infectious. Besides, Selena's no worse than everyone around her. Preening womanizers, backstabbing senators, corrupt lobbyists, faux-enlightened Aspen donors who got rich ripping off hip-hop musicians, and even her own ex-husband, a philandering real estate crook. Selena is enabled by staffers who either fawn over her, like her dim personal aide Gary, that's Tony Hale, or more often think she's a bleeping moron, like her hustling chief of staff played by Anna Chlumsky. Seeing their boss as a meal ticket and a step up the ladder, they don't believe in anything either. Such freewheeling cynicism makes it tempting to call Veep the farcical doppelganger of Game of Thrones. Yet this isn't quite accurate, for despite its Hobbesian war of all against all, Game of Thrones gives us genuine heroes. This isn't true of Veep, a live-action cartoon in which everyone is either a fool, a knave, or a monster. Nobody gets off scot-free, including the audience. We hope you enjoy watching these pathetic, nasty creatures, the show says with a cheery grin. You let them run your country.
John Powers reviewed Veep, which ends its 7-season run on Sunday. Friday on Fresh Air, we'll feature interviews from our archives with 2 stars of Veep, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tony Hale. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll examine some of the unanswered questions about Donald Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank. Our guest will be David Enrich of the New York Times, who's investigated how and why the bank kept loaning Trump money even after he'd defaulted on tens of millions in loans. Trump has sued to prevent the bank from releasing his financial records to 2 congressional committees that have subpoenaed them. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.